Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Selected Pros. Good to have you back. This episode is a slight change in direction for what has previously been a fiction podcast. We're talking to Brandon Gauthier. He's a professor of history for Fordham University. He completed his doctorate in modern history at Fordham University in 2016. He is the director of global education at the Derryfield School as well. His first book, published by Selected Pros' favorite Tortoise Books, is titled Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim. It's an examination of the lives and the youths of the 20th century's most heinous dictators. I don't want to spend too much time on this introduction because Brandon and I speak a lot about this book at length, a lot about evil, about humanizing these characters. And Brandon has so much to say. He's a wonderful guest, a fantastic writer. Something that Brandon has achieved that I'm not sure a lot of historians achieve, and you know, kind of maybe an absence Brandon has noticed in academic historical writing is the absence of feeling and of style. So that's something we talk about at length. Brandon has so much to say. He says it so well and so passionately. He's a really fantastic guest, and I know you guys are going to love this episode. And before I go, I want to read you a review of Brandon from ratemyprofessors.com. Professor Gauthier is one of the best teachers I have taken at Fordham. He is very loud and passionate about his work. He makes history feel more like a story than just a list of facts. You do not have to be a history fan to like his class. He makes it interesting. Here's Brandon Gauthier, author of Before Evil.
Hey, what's going on, John? How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing just fine, man. It's a crazy Sunday. It's a crazy Sunday.
What happened?
Just living, man. Just taking care of kids.
Yeah.
Just rearing children and doing lots of gardening and building a fence around my vegetable garden.
It's
my
funny.
Dog will not destroy it.
I was just talking to my wife about our future, and basically everything you just said is everything that I want. So sounds good. A fence, a garden, a dog, some kids. Sounds
yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. It's but a
I'm
huge,
sure it's a busy time as well.
Yeah. It's a huge win. Well, it's, I think it's really particularly wonderful to get outside and get dirty and dig in the dirt. And, you know, my daughter's 5 and she's all about it. So that's really fun. Stuff like that. Then she'll talk a big game about how she'll eat the tomatoes and everything else to come. But then, you know, she doesn't really follow through on that. She also loves salmon, allegedly.
Interesting.
She doesn't really follow through on that. But, you know, that being said, it's nice to get a chance to talk to you. I enjoy Selected Pros a lot. Enjoyed a lot of the interviews. So it's been fun. I missed the Tao one earlier. I missed the Tao Lin one from August. And so I was listening to that earlier. It's particularly interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I have to say, I read a lot of, you know, books of people that, you know, might come on the show or people that are coming on the show. And this one was really, really something incredible, I thought. So I mean, for those who don't know, it's Before Evil. It's coming out. It's from, you know, coming out from Tortoise, right? And is it out already or is it?
Yeah, it just came out on April 27th.
So. April 27th. Okay. For some reason, I thought it was this month. But,
yeah.
You know, I've been reading my secret galley version. So, But you know what? It's phenomenal. And it's a perfect time for me personally, because as much as I'm posting a new interview with Bud Smith, which, you know, I hope you'll like. But there's only so many ways you can talk about, you know, fiction and writing and, oh, what kind of pencil do you use? Do you use a laptop or a typewriter? You know, so it's been interesting for me personally to kind of start thinking about switching into more of the realm of nonfiction. And this is a wonderful way to kind of bridge the gap. But why don't you tell us a little bit about just sort of like the book and where the idea came from? I know you're a professor of history at Fordham, right? And a PhD as well.
Yeah, I did my doctorate at Fordham and then I'm adjunct professor of history for Fordham. And I'm also the director of global education at a school in New Hampshire. But I would say I appreciate your kind words about the book, John. I really do. And I think, you know, to speak for myself, and I imagine other writers will relate, it's like, you know, you spend so much time by yourself working on something. It's a solitary craft.
If you have friends and family, you tell about it, right? But they're particularly excited for it to come out because they've been hearing about it so much. Like, they don't want to hear about it anymore, you know? They want it to come out so other people will hopefully want to talk with you about it. So it's especially joyful to have it out and to have people be reading it. I started in July of 2018. So, you know, we're coming up on 4 years here.
Oh, wow.
And that was like active work time. So I would say too, like, you know, in terms of the split between nonfiction and fiction, one thing that I have found particularly interesting is the effort to embrace a different style that I think is a whole missing from a lot of historical works. There are many men and women who are absolutely brilliant historians who do great work that's really important for my own, but I'm really interested in accessibility. And I have been increasingly interested in drawing on writers who inspire me. And whether, like, if we're looking across the board, like, what is the biggest influence in terms of my writing? Like, you know, I would start with Bret Easton Ellis when I was in high school. Mm. So, like, I should be saying, I don't know, like, Stephen Kotkin at Princeton, who's written these three, the third one's still to come out, but like these massive biographies on Stalin. And in terms of erudition and being at the very forefront of his field, no one's, it's going to be very difficult to outdo Stephen Kotkin, but he doesn't write like Bret Easton Ellis. Mm-hmm. And I think that my aspiration is not to write like Bret Easton Ellis, but to do something distinct that's going to stand out.
Yeah.
It's going to challenge the norms of how historical writing is written, but also is going to reflect to a certain extent indie lit influences and, you know, authors that I think are particularly brilliant writers. So I'd be happy to tell you a little bit about the book. It's Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Mussolini, and Kim. And it's a work that looks at the humanity of inhumanity, which is not a phrase we hear very often. Mm-hmm. These are some of the worst people who ever lived. Their guilt in terms of the crimes against humanity that they committed is absolute. But I think all too often when we think about history from a popular realm, we tend to see, like, you know, the notion of like Satan incarnate, like, you know, we see like demons, whereas the reality is it's the story of crimes against humanity is a problem with Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that human beings do. Really interesting, that human story. And so the book is looking at not only their crimes in the first part, who they were as human beings, but who were they as young people? And to what extent do we share parallels? And there are a lot of parallels. And I think there's a larger intellectual purpose of that.
Well, I really like the idea. I think you're citing like another thinker, another historian, but they essentially say, you know, the kind of boring, for me at least, the boring question that I'm sure you get asked a lot is like, well, what are the implications of humanizing these men, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not boring. I guess it's an obvious question, but, you know, there's somebody, and I forget their name, in your book, you had mentioned this thought that, like, you know, the flatulence of Hitler, right? Like inhumanizing Hitler is actually subversive, because what you're doing is you're subverting the cult and this notion, this kind of like mythological or inhuman pedestal that we put them on, right? Like, he's beyond human. But when you humanize him, it actually is sort of really like an ethical way of dealing with evil, quote unquote, evil leaders.
Well, I think it's a really important question. And it's something I thought about a lot, because in one sense, you're engaging the story of human lives. You know, the crucial question is, well, why? And does humanizing in some sense, do you risk romanticizing people who did utterly awful things? And to be very clear, when the book's called Before Evil, when we're talking about evil, we're talking about causing immense suffering to other human beings,
mm-hmm.
to cause other people's sorrow of an unspeakable nature, and to not feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, not only not to feel bad, but to feel like you had done something inherently right, well, that's evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we ask the question, you know, of why should we be humanizing these human beings, the answer to that is that if we look at evil as something that is inherently beyond Homo sapiens, that this is something only explainable within the context of another realm of evil that comes from nowhere, that right. suggests that we can never get to the bottom of how such things come to be. I challenge readers to think about the explicability of humanity's inclination to commit crimes against humanity. How does ideological fanaticism, really dogmatic, radical ideas, lead people to embrace this line of thought that becomes evil, where I don't feel for your sorrow anymore. I don't feel for the pain that I cause you. It's because I care
so deeply about the suffering that these individuals cause. And I think we all care so deeply that I think we should humanize the very worst among us. I think it does two things. One, it demonstrates, it speaks back to what historians, what we're trying to do, men and women trying to look at a slice of reality as something that we can make sense of, that life itself has meaning, and the study of it, the study of what has happened, is an effort to render that into some type of accessible format where we can learn from it. Two, I think we should be different from Hitler and Stalin and Mao and Lenin and so on. And what does that mean? It means to embrace what they did not, which is to show compassion and empathy, even for those who don't deserve it. That doesn't mean that you don't hold people accountable. You do. But to embrace empathy and compassion and love and mercy, even as we hold people accountable, and to tell the human stories of how such people come to be. I say in the book that it's not the height of complicity. It's the antithesis of their tyranny. I think the section that you were referencing was, the works of a writer like Simon Sebag Montefiore. If listeners are potentially if they're interested in this vein of history that's kind of inspired what I'm doing, I would push them towards Simon Sebag Montefiore's Court of the Red Tsar, which is about Stalin. And it is a form of history which is going to bring a degree of humanity to this discussion. For instance, what I mean by that, talking about relationships, being willing to talk about the things that we have in common, sorrow, as well as triumphs in their lives, so to speak, before they ever become these ideologically monstrous people. So I say, that Stalin, Simon Sebag Montefiore, has made him come alive. That despot was, as historian Stephen Kotkin, aforementioned, stresses, quote, a human being who collected watches, played skittles and billiards, loved gardening and Russian steam baths. Hitler in power was, quote, given to uncontrolled farting, Kotkin also notes, for whatever it's worth. The question is, if we include these facts, what's the so what there? What's the point where someone says, why should I care about any of that before the specter of something like the Holocaust? If we're to understand how such evil comes to be, we have to tell the story of real people. And real people are oftentimes relatable in certain ways that can be uncomfortable. But if we only other the very worst among us and don't examine human stories, we fail to realize that we ourselves can become monstrous through embracing radical ideas that begin to suggest that empathy for you is not necessary. In fact, that it's a defect.
That it holds back the mission, the greater, the good of the movement or of the society as they envision it, and empathy would do damage to that.
Yeah. I'm also interested in the notion of how does feeling inform our study of history? Because, as a whole, like when you're in an academic setting, the notion of inspiring feeling is not really the core goal of historians. It's supposed to be like a really cold-blooded, academic analysis. And I challenge that in this. I say that there's more to be written about these despots, even though they've had thousands of books written about them before evil actions came to define them, that I think we should feel disgust, sadness, and even sympathy for these bastards, and recognize that doing so is the antithesis of their tyranny rather than the height of complicity, to repeat that phrase again. And I draw on Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he stated, is, quote, by the activity of the passions that our reason improves itself. A degree of feeling can encourage deeper thought through fostering emotional investment, the type of personal connection that makes critical thinking more experiential and meaningful. There's Mary Wollstonecraft, who said during the Enlightenment, and puts it more cogently, we reason deeply when we forcibly feel. So grapple with the humanity of those people you find absolutely repugnant. Identify with them on a personal level by focusing on a time when they were young and anonymous, struggling with personal circumstances beyond their control, and feel revulsion at doing as much. And ponder your own susceptibility to dogma, righteousness leading to cruelty. Feel the human dignity of the very worst people in history as a means of affirming your own.
So the interesting thing to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like at the end of the day, when you're looking at the lives of each of these men, there aren't predictors. You cannot really go back and peg certain behaviors as indicative or traumas or anything as indicative of something that might produce a Lenin or a Mao or a Hitler or a Stalin in the future. And in fact, one of the first things you talk about and demonstrate, very effectively is the presence of like parental love that each of these men had. And so, you know, I know that ultimately it can't quite be predicted, but like, can you kind of tell us about that investigation and some of the patterns you did find among their lives?
Yeah. So when we look at history as being explicable, which is, I think, our obligation, that there's something to learn, we also have to be careful in that, you know, we all want to come away with like a mathematical formula that demonstrates how we're going to avoid tyrants in the future. You know, can we come up with like a math problem that's going to involve 35 variables mm-hmm. and we can check all these boxes, like, okay, now we see that this person could be a really monstrous despot. What I argue in this book is that the most important factors in their lives is one, not only do they have some trauma matters, trauma is important, but I don't feel like that's the decisive factor in their lives. The most important one is that they all have really good educations. They all fall in love with books. They're all major bibliophiles.
The myth making. They fall in love with myth making. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Victor Hugo is everything for young Benito Mussolini. And you have Lenin falling in love with Russian literature. Stalin spending his time with Dostoevsky. Really, in his favorite book later on, is Last of the Mohicans. Every one of these individuals as a young person benefits from having a mother who's a good mom and deeply wedded to their education and the fact that their child should have opportunities. And the most important number one point of their youths is that they have the opportunity to read and to go to school. And so the question that begs is, well, why is that important? Their crimes would be defined by ideological radicalism. The ability to engage with the world of ideas and books and to become writers themselves was profoundly important for their ability to embrace the later ideas that would define their quote unquote careers. Mm-hmm. So one, they have loving mothers who give them certain opportunities. They fall in love with books. They engage with the world of ideas. And then two, they are susceptible, like so many young people, to believing that they're going to make the world a better place. The total conviction that they will have the ability to bend reality to their will, and they could do it even before they could identify what the means of their ideas would be. You know, before Hitler is the vicious anti-Semite that we see emerging out of Vienna, before Lenin becomes a frothing of the mouth radical Marxist, they are falling in love with ideas and they're beginning to think about how they could shape the world around them. So when we look at their lives, some of the worst people who ever lived, individuals whose guilt is absolute. Nothing I say in this conversation, nothing that is said in this book can ever diminish their guilt. It's mm-hmm. absolute. The evil they cause, that has to be front and center. That's the first third of the book. But the question of, so what do we learn from studying their lives? I see these common parallels, but then we return to the notion of, well, are you trying to say that like the next Mussolini, the next fascist dictator is like, that's the 15-year-old reading Victor Hugo? Mm-hmm. Is that our takeaway, that we see a 16-year-old reading Les Mis, that we should like tackle him and take the book away?
That's like what people are looking. They're looking for that kind of indicator, and they're just never going to find it, right? Because in the book, you even say like, well, plenty of brilliant people, plenty of people read Victor Hugo and go on to be physicians. And like, so it's irrelevant, right?
Utterly normal people. Well, the reality is this, the larger takeaway. Hegel said in his philosophy of history that the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. And he wasn't, he wasn't being sarcastic when he said it. You know, he noted that during the French Revolution, people will look to ancient Rome and scream for guidance. What should we do in this moment? The reality is that, the world, the nature of our existence, is an endlessly evolving degree of variables. Picture a wall full of a billion numbers that are constantly shifting, an algorithm of life, which is constantly jumping ahead and changing and evolving. We try to identify variables that are gonna be like a math problem. That's not reality. This conversation can never be recreated. Our existence in our minds talking to one another, the variables, the day I've had, the day you've had, this could never be perfectly recreated ever again, because mm-hmm. there's almost an infinity of variables shaping how we engage with one another right now. It might be similar in the future. It may or may not be, but it's never going to be the same. So when you look at the story of these dictators' lives, there's not a math problem that demonstrates how tyranny comes to be. There are parallels which are important, which I think we study. And the most important takeaway on all of that is the problem of crimes against humanity, I repeat, is a human problem born of ideological radicalism. I am not special. We are all susceptible to becoming fanatical about ideas. And once we begin to become that, we start to ask, well, there is this really disturbing thing that must be done. But if we don't do it, are we complicit with evil? And if we really are committed to these larger ideas, shouldn't we be doing what needs to be done? But what if it's particularly horrible? But is there a larger end that will justify it? And then you become the villain, but you don't realize it. Mm-hmm. You look in the mirror and say, I'm doing what has to be done.
I didn't want to, but couldn't help thinking about our current historical moment, I guess. And yeah. I mean, unfortunately, yesterday in Buffalo was, I don't know if you've heard the news, but
yeah, it's just so
yet another like phrase that you use a lot in the book, noxious idea that kind of took hold. And, you know, it's a similar kind of rabid fanaticism that this person had and like did something horrible. How, I was like, it was an interesting time to be reading your book because I'm like, nothing has changed. And I really love the Kissinger quote that you include in your book, which is, you say human beings don't repeat past errors, they make new ones. And then Kissinger says, we will not make the same old mistakes he said knowingly of the Nixon administration in 1969, we will make our own. And so it seems that new mistakes are made, but they kind of, they have the structure of past mistakes.
You know, the trend of mass shootings and the targeting of people of color, the targeting of the Jewish community is so heartbreaking and so enraging. And so like in a moment like this, I don't know, what can one say other than just total heartbreak and total grief over how these things come to be? And as we look at how these things come to be, I think an essential step towards trying to understand what I think is evil, what happened in Buffalo is evil. You're causing mass suffering and pain on a scale that is unimaginable, that is going to ripple throughout time. And the fact that such individuals carry out such actions, believing, and I'm making assumptions because this is just happening yesterday, but from what I read thus far, we have a racist fanatic based on what's been said thus far who believes what he is doing is right. Well, that keeps me up at night. I lose sleep over that. How is it that you're going to cause mass suffering and harm and misery and believe that what you're doing is right? Mm-hmm. It's so repugnant. So the book itself, right, when we think about the individuals we're talking about, you know, Adolf Hitler's responsible for the murder of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children, Second World War, the death of 50 million people. One out of five people died in the Soviet Union as a result of the Nazi invasion there. I think we have the obligation to grapple with the humanity of people who do such horrible things because monsters aren't real. People are monstrous, but monsters don't actually exist. We do. Mm-hmm. And we're susceptible to ideological radicalism of varying degrees that can manifest itself in some really, really awful ways. I'd like to read, if I can, the last paragraph of the book, because I think it speaks to what we're talking about.
Yeah, and, please do.
I don't know. I think it would be fair, right, for someone listening or someone reading the book to say, like, what is the point here? Like, what, you know, you're talking about the humanity of inhumanity, but can you say something more on that? Can you elaborate? You know, you're spending your time looking at the human stories of Joseph Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini. You know, it makes me think of one thing a professor said to me, you know, a reader, when I was working on this. And there's a chapter in the book that talks about Hitler losing his mother to breast cancer. And it's a crushing moment for him when he's a teenager. He's not yet a Nazi dictator. He's kind of a never-do-well teenager wannabe artist. And the professor said to me, you know, who cares? Who cares that Hitler loved his mother? Who cares about that before the specter of the Holocaust? Mm-hmm. Is that a worthwhile use of our time? And I return to this notion of, you know, grappling with the humanity of people who go on to do awful things, because it's a reminder of what we have in common. And it's a reminder of our own susceptibility to ideological radicalism once we begin to see other human beings where we like to only see monsters. Mm-hmm. And then the larger takeaway, you know, what is the point of all this? Well, if the entire book is worth anything, I think it's worth this last paragraph, which is the lesson, quote unquote, that we derive from the youths of these awful men is recognizing that we ourselves can become the monsters we deplore. As we make hard decisions in pursuit of what we believe is right, grappling with infinite complexities and personal challenges, we can guard against that reality by embracing empathy. This guiding value can shield us from the blinding light we often run towards in pursuit of far-reaching ends that may seemingly compel us to undertake cold means, reject the tuneful dogmatism of sirens who pull us towards disaster by ignoring or denying the humanity of others, including the heinous. Encourage new generations to think of their actions through the lens of suffering we cause or diminish for others. Distinguish yourself by striving to interpret the meaning of human experience, past and present, with compassion, even if it's also often lacking in history. Courageous opposition is needed to confront tyranny over the ages, but so too is love and mercy. The onus is on us. What happens when empathy becomes a defect? What happens when my need to feel for you as a human being, and not just to ask you like, how are you doing, you know, just because we're supposed to be polite, but to actually take an interest in other people and think about what it means to be them. Mm-hmm. I repeat, the human condition to be sitting right now, us talking, looking out our eyes, and what you mm-hmm. say to me matters. What I say to you matters. So once we lose sight of how our actions affect other people and the suffering we can cause, that's a bad road. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to suggest that every single one of us, you know, is innately a Hannibal Lecter, you know, waiting to come to the forefront. But I really do believe we're all capable of cruelty, big and small. And the only antidote to that is love and compassion and empathy alongside courage and strength.
How do you think, let's try to use, maybe let's think of like a concrete. So I want to say something that I think is a really good artistic choice that you made in this book is in the sections about these men, you refer to them as their childhood names. Which I really appreciated. It has this really kind of disarming effect. But so let's take like Lenin, who Volodya, is that what they called him as a kid?
Yeah.
I didn't know that actually. So Volodya, Lenin used to be Volodya. That was his nickname. Where was the point, do you think, in his life where he substituted fanaticism for empathy? Like, where did he kind of, when did he become so obsessed with this global communist dictatorship that he forgot what it was like to be a person and to see other people as people? Like, where do we lose that along the line?
Well, now we have to tell a human story. And I think that's what's so distasteful to a lot of people. You have individuals who've done absolutely horrific things. In the Russian Civil War, you know, if some 13 million Russians die. Lenin's guilt in terms of crimes against humanity in the Russian Civil War is absolute. So if the question of how do we begin to understand how Lenin came to embrace ideological fanaticism, it's not only one that can arise from studying like Lenin's infatuation with Marxism. Mm-hmm. It's a human story. And so we return to this notion of the necessity of humanizing those that we find utterly repugnant. Why? For the sake of trying to understand how individuals go down these roads. Mm-hmm. The story of Lenin is this. He comes from a lovely family. He comes from a family that he has Christmas trees growing up. They dye Easter eggs. He goes sledding. He has a really good mom who's a great pedagogue, teaches him to pun in French and German while growing up. They start a faux literary journal, him and his siblings, called Saturday. And they have sheet music lying around, leading academic journals from Petersburg. So it's a lovely childhood in many respects. He has no interest in really politics at all growing up. He has an older brother named Sasha. And Sasha, for him, kind of sets an example to follow. His brother's a straight A student. Young Lenin becomes a straight A student. And by the way, he's known as Volodya in the book. I'll say really quickly on that, I'm not going to refer to these despots how they would have liked to have been referred to. Hitler would have preferred the Führer, you know, or Hitler. No, I'm going to call him Adolf. I'm not going to reinforce cults of personality. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to call Stalin Stalin and as of the man in steel. I'll call him So-So. That's what his mother called him as a little boy. Back to Lenin. Mm-hmm. Lenin comes from a wonderful family. His older brother sets an example to follow. And so Volodya reads, you know, novels as a teenager. He's really into Turgenev. He reads, so particularly throughout the project, I went back and read a lot of the books, the novels that inspired them. So I spent a long time reading Turgenev, Smoke in particular. And then his older brother goes to college. And lots of kids go off to college, become Marxist. Very few go off to college and become terrorists. His older brother, Sasha, went off to St. Petersburg University. Their father dies while he's away at school. And he becomes involved in some bad circles, some reading circles, where they begin to read Marx, which is, you know, something that is fairly common, right? But he becomes radicalized. And his older brother, Sasha, begins to believe that there is a way to understand this world. And dialectical materialism, the stages of history that Marx outlines, this is the future. And yet we live in this oppressive society with this horrible government that does not allow us to organize and talk and speak openly. And then Sasha decides he's going to try to kill Tsar Alexander III. And he enters into that conspiracy, open-eyed, believing he might die, but utterly radical. It falls apart. And now I'd ask listeners to think of a 17-year-old, Volodya, future communist dictator, who's never had any interest in politics. And he opens a letter, and the letter's from Petersburg, and it says that Sasha's been arrested. And he's been arrested for a conspiracy to kill the Tsar. Volodya will reflect that all my older brother ever wanted to do was study worms. You know, he wanted to be a professor. Mm-hmm. And he just looks at their mother and says this in a very understated way, this could end badly for Sasha. Their mother rushes to St. Petersburg to try to save his older brother. And he's not sorry at all. Picture a mother and son sobbing. And Sasha, Lenin's older brother, looks at the mom and says, I'm not sorry. It's the right thing to do. It is the right thing to do to try to kill the Tsar, which, by the way, would have involved a public bombing with poison-laced shrapnel that would have killed other men, women, and children. But he's utterly convinced that we had to do this. And so Lenin's older brother is hanged. He's taking final exams when it happens. He aces a trigonometry exam. He's doing translations of Thucydides. And a friend finds him sitting outside, and he won't talk, and just very quietly says, they hanged my brother. The turning point, a moment that changed how Lenin would think about the future, came with the death of his brother. Young Volodya starts with the point that he must have believed what he was doing was right. My older brother was a good person. He had to have believed what he was doing was right. And if that was true, then young Volodya could trace his ideas. He could understand. He could read What Is to Be Done. By Nikolai Chernyshevsky. Listeners, if you're interested in understanding the origins of ideological terror in the Soviet Union, read the novel What Is to Be Done by Nikolai Chernyshevsky. It was written in prison and it's written in code. And I can't believe Tsarist authorities let the guy publish it, but it was profoundly important. And you're not going to read about people being tortured and murdered. You're going to read about a seamstress shop where Vera Pavlovna envisions a world without rich and poor, where men and women live in total equality, and how we could bring this socialist reality to bear. We could bring this to fruition. And so Lenin becomes radicalized. My brother gave his life for this. He becomes inspired by Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done. And he begins to believe that we have the obligation to help bring about this reality. There's a scene, him sitting in a European cafe in exile. And someone asks, you know, what is a good person? And Lenin at this point in his 30s winces. What is a good person, quote unquote? He winces at the nonsense of the intelligentsia about moral consciousness. Any action, regardless of how extreme one might consider it, is acceptable if it helps put an end to class oppression. The stakes are a new world for mankind. No rules in the pursuit of paradise. No room for bourgeois morality. In 1892, there's a famine around his hometown. His sister's trying to aid the poor. Young Lenin's response. Volodya becomes Vladimir Lenin by this point. His response to the famine in 1892, let them die. Let the deaths of the poor hasten the collapse of capitalism and the arrival of the revolution, the worse, the better. If you went back and challenged him, he would laugh. He'd say, yeah, I'm the son of a landlord. That's true. But he would say, what side are you on? What are you doing for this revolution? You are for whom? For the revolution or against it? If against it, to the wall. So if we recognize the humanity of inhumanity, meaning that human beings go down that road, how can we be different? Mm. You know, that's the most important takeaway. How can we be different? When Mussolini's executed, he's put in front of a gate with his mistress, and he's shot. And then their dead bodies are taken into Milan, and they're hung upside down from a gas station, but not before women urinate on the bodies, and the bodies are desecrated. Mussolini's head is bashed in, and then they're hung upside down. And an anti-fascist journalist will remark, to execute them was justice. To spare their lives would have been sacred. Mm. How can we be different? And if we took a particular political figure whom I find absolutely repugnant, that I think has really been horrible for this country, And I absolutely deplore this person. And there were a group of people that were going to harm that person. We're going to rage on that person. Would I stand in front of them? Would I look at the mob and say, you're not going to rip them apart? We're not going to go that way. Would you be willing to take those that you find most utterly repugnant? Doesn't mean they're not going to be punished. Doesn't mean they're not going to be accountable. Doesn't mean that they may not sit in a cell for the rest of their life, depending on what they've done, and have to think about the harm they caused. But would you stand in front of that person? Would you challenge the mob to not rip that person to shreds? Would you even struggle to defend the human dignity of a person who never respected anyone else's human dignity? Now, I think we're in a difficult place. I think that's the only road. The only road is to recognize the humanity of all. Once we begin to suggest that other people, well, they're not deserving of human compassion or a degree of empathy or feeling, it's a very bad road to go down.
Which of these men, if any, felt most human to you? Was there any that you had an even hard, who gave you the kind of the hardest time stomaching their descent into fanaticism and, you know, crimes against humanity? Like,
I mean, it sounds like the expected answer, but Hitler as a young person is just deeply unlikable. And obviously this will be, you know, one of the most evil people who ever lives, right? But him as a young person before, he is a tyrant. You know, if you ask listeners, like, what do you expect from Hitler's youth? You know, you would think, well, he's probably torturing animals. You know, he would reflect something like you would see out of a serial killer. And that's not the truth at all. I mean, all he really wants to do as a young person, and this is the part that's, you know, least distasteful, is, you know, he wants to be an artist. And that's the part that's maybe, you know, there's a degree of relatability there, which should make listeners and should make readers and makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, I can find myself thinking about teenage Hitler just really wanting as a teenager to kind of be a bohemian and to just like draw and do art all day long. Mm-hmm. And and again, someone might say, who cares? Why are you bringing this up? Because again, we see human beings, we see human origins of crimes against humanity, but he's just totally insufferable. Meaning that he's just the arrogance is so overwhelming. And the total, and this is also part of, you see this across all six dictators, just total conviction in their righteousness, just absolute faith that they can change the world and they're going to do something great. And Hitler's this kind of odd mix of, he's very pathetic. He's a pathetic individual at times as a teenager, where like, he has nothing good going on. He's terrible at school, as actually many famous and infamous people are, who go on to do big things for better or for much, much worse. He struggles in school, and he'll have to like make up stories later on about like how he did so poorly in school. Like, one story he'll repeat is that like, the only time I ever got drunk was when I left school and I had my report card, you know, and I got drunk, and you know, then I used the report card to wipe my ass, and I fell asleep, and then I woke up the next morning. So he makes up stories like that were probably apocryphal, that weren't real, like showing his disdain for school and how much he hated teachers. But he really only has like one friend, August Kubizek, Gustl. And like, him and his friend basically just like go into the hills, and like young Hitler, young Adolf, as I call him throughout the book, just like rants to his only friend. And it was this really weird relationship. There's a really interesting book called The Hidden Hitler, and it raises the question of whether, you know, Adolf Hitler was a homosexual and whether he had same-sex relationships. There's no certain proof of that, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that says, yes, he might have had a same-sex relationship with August Kubizek, with Gustl, which again, a listener might say, why should I care? And I would say that because Adolf Hitler was a relatable human being in many respects. There are certain things about him that were normal, that I think many of us can relate to, right? That he had a sexuality. He had a side to him that was, to some extent, you know, inherently human. Mm-hmm. So I think he, as a young person, is difficult to stomach. But Mussolini is especially bad, though. He's a delinquent kid. He is constantly getting in trouble. But as he gets older, he is really abhorrent in his behavior towards women. And even in a pre-World War I memoir, he openly admits to sexual assault, and does not reflect any regret about having caused someone such misery. Mm-hmm. So there are elements of their stories that are, you know, instances of relatable human beings. And then there are these other instances where it's just utterly repugnant. And it's really a challenge to write about this person in a way that stays true to the core purpose of the book, which is to tell human stories. But yeah, their stories often provoke revulsion. Here's, for listeners, Mussolini at the height of his power. The same time, if he's a repugnant human being, he at the height of his power remains a confounding contradiction. Benito Mussolini was a shameless opportunist who invented an ideology, a warmonger who proclaimed peace, a philanderer who supposedly loved his wife. Quote, "You have been for me the only woman whom I have ever really loved," he wrote to his wife just before dying with his mistress. A passionate bibliophile who ignored basic facts, a loving father who spent little time with his kids, a tyrant who slept well as his world disintegrated. Death should have taken him on many prior occasions. He had survived an ugly wound from friendly fire in the First World War, violent sewer duels, including one in 1921 when he nearly kills a newspaper editor, car and airplane crashes, numerous assassination attempts. He was both cautious and reckless, a man who, quote, "combined the ferocity of the tyrant with the hesitations of a child, an individual who bragged his skull was bulletproof. It wasn't. Yet feared injections at the doctor's office, a fascist who sought to create a totalitarian regime in Italy, a war criminal responsible for a million deaths, but also a tragic buffoon who became lost in a dream until its consequences shook him awake. War was a stern teacher, after all."
So two things you said. On the other end of that question, I guess, is there somebody who was, which of these guys to you had the least abhorrent upbringing?
Lenin, for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like that. And so it surprised you probably the most.
Lenin and Mao Zedong has an abusive father, but he grows up in a really fairly privileged home. His dad's a successful capitalist, which is a fun, interesting fact. Mm-hmm. Lenin, when he's at the height of his power, will say of a questionnaire of his class background, "nobleman." And in 1921, he'll write "nobleman," which is a grim joke because he's sending those people to their deaths. Mao, at the height of his power, when asked about his childhood, will say, "well, I came from a family of rich peasants," which is an interesting turn of phrase. He grows up on a farm, in which his dad's super prosperous in terms of being a capitalist anyway. He's not wealthy, but he's really pretty well off in comparison to everyone else. And he stays up late at night reading books like Water Margin, a classic Chinese novel. And he, describes being with like a little vegetable oil flame curled up at night with like this huge tome. And he has to hang curtains over his window so his dad won't catch him reading in the middle of the night. So he has an interesting childhood, and his dad is stern towards him. Like Mao Zedong as an adult will like be meeting in 1971. He's meeting with like the prime minister of Japan, and he goes from like talking about the strength of a cocktail to be like, "this is like a 65 proof drink." And then kind of like gazes off in like the distance and says, "my father was a stern man." And then goes on to say, like, "I would have him jet planed," which is from the Cultural Revolution, where they pull your arms back to the point of breaking. He says, "if he were alive right now, I'd have him jet planed." And by the way, so here's something I would emphasize. A lot of what I'm talking about, these are things that are all too often considered trivial by historians. Mm-hmm. Like, people have long looked at the relationship with their parents, right? But, people would be like, do we really have to reference the moment where Mao like looks off in the distance and like quietly says, my father was a stern man," like something clearly much larger is there. Right. I would say we should. I talk about a lot of human details, which some of the very best historians kind of think are trivial. And I don't, I think the human stories are really, really important. Mao Zedong, the human being as an adult, is a very, very scary one.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes from a place of a remarkable degree of privilege. And that same father who is abusive towards him physically and makes him work on the farm, sends him to like all these different schools. At one point he's a teacher. Mao Zedong at one point is a school teacher. He gets in trouble for having sex in the dorms with his first wife, way too loudly. So he gets in trouble for that. And then when he teaches, he won't wear a shirt. And then when he's criticized for not wearing a shirt, he says, "you're lucky I'm not nude."
There's such an element in all of these men of hypocrisy that
endless.
Yeah. Which I guess is, we all sort of take that for granted, but
all right. Well, let's relate that. Right. So First off, they're all constant liars.
Mm.
Anything that doesn't meet their ideological vision is, immediately reformulated to what they think is right. And someone might say, like, isn't the story of all these men just that like they're power hungry cynics, and they're just going to kill many, many people till they can rule without question of being challenged? And they are power hungry and they are cynics, but they're ideological fanatics. And the story of how they behave in power is one of ideological motivation. and they do things that are irrational. It's not only that they're hypocritical liars, they do things that driven by their ideas, which are clearly bad for themselves and their country. Mao Zedong implements the Great Leap Forward. 45 million people starved to death in China. And even from Mao's cold-hearted point of view of like, there's this larger end, it's a complete utter disaster by any measure of what he thought he was trying to achieve, building communism in China. And he doubles down. I mean, when people criticize him, he's like, no, this is the way forward. And like, it's so obviously has the potential to destabilize him. Nazi Germany at the end of World War II and the commitment to this like anti-Semitic heinous worldview is real. Even as the Soviet Union is approaching German borders, they still continue to carry out mass murder. Even when resources, German soldiers, like logistically, right? Like they could like prioritize resources for saving German lives. They prioritize murdering.
I mean, have you read The Kindly Ones by Jonathan Littell? So that's such an interesting, like, you know, the exploration of like their commitment to the process and resources and right up until the very end being so fanatical that they're measuring out rations like to keep the camps running and to keep their soldiers alive. And like, you know, it's insanity. But I think that was a really good, I think that's a really interesting point you bring up. Like, even in the face of death, the fanaticism wins.
And nothing seemingly can break through that veil.
Which is
what raises the question of when we become so, so ingrained to a certain belief system, right? And we really believe it and it starts to be challenged. And you don't see it, like you won't listen to it. Like there are things I can think of in contemporary American politics, like with loved ones. I'm like, how can you not see, like, how can you not see it? Yeah. And they really don't. And they, it's so overwhelming. And okay. And even that, it begins to get to a point where you're like, these beliefs are causing people harm. Like this type of demagogic populism, this type of radicalism, like is causing real suffering. And people don't see it. Some people do. We're capable. We have agency. But I think the idea here is returning to the framing theme of all of this. Are our ideas guided by empathy for others? Do we embrace whatever beliefs we embrace? But is humility a part of that? John, I'm wrong all the time. Like, I wish that wasn't the case. But I can look back on things from 10 years ago and I'm like, I think I was off on that. What am I off on now?
Yeah.
And if I don't allow you to speak and challenge me or someone else who disagrees with the book, I think I have the obligation to listen and to think that, you know, I don't have the market cornered on the very meaning of reality. My commitment is to telling human stories and urging people to be empathetic and to be the opposite of some of the men we're talking about.
Yeah. So earlier you mentioned something about detail, and detail carries so much weight. Small detail about these men's lives carries so much weight in this narrative, right? Like Hitler, like, you know, not to be, you know, inappropriate, but we talked about it already. So like Hitler's farting in powerful moments. That to me is like, I mean, it's comical, right? But it's like, just like what Miles says about his father being a stern man, it is a moment that means a million things, and the details. So the details carry a lot of weight here. I wanted to ask you.
And by the way, John, I would say Hitler, the cult of personality larger than life, the last, it would be the antithesis of what how he wanted to be viewed. Hitler didn't want to be viewed as a human being. He didn't want to be viewed as an ordinary person. He even, you know, hides his relationship with Eva Braun for that reason. So the discussion, like, you know, of Hitler and farting, well, that's the antithesis of everything Hitler wanted for his legacy. Exactly. Doesn't want to be viewed as a relatable human being who has bodily functions like everybody else. That is to challenge his cult of personality. It is a rejection of a myth, a myth that causes great harm when you talk about those humanizing details. And I think that as long as we're framing that within the context of what we're trying to do, I think that we could have those discussions, and I think we should.
And you know, you mentioned a writer in your book that I really, really love, who I would argue is almost insanely keen on detail, which is Peter Longerich. It was great for me to be reading your book while I'm reading right now. I'm reading his book, Goebbels. And, you know, that comes from his diaries, you know, the vast majority of the book is just chronologically following Goebbels's diaries, insane amounts of detail to the point that, you know, it does have a similar effect that your book has, which is humanizing Goebbels, although he can't seem to do it without expressing his absolute disgust and repulsion of like who Goebbels was as a person, who, again, even in his personal life and his youth, is, I'm sure you know, a really insufferable individual. But I'm super curious because I love Longerich. I'd love to know what you think about him, but also is sort of mining for details, right? You discuss at the end of the book, like primary sources. I would love to know how that process operates. Like what are you looking for when you go into Hitler's life? Like what kind of details are you looking to set apart? Because I'm sure your answer will be informed a lot by what you think about Longerich, but I'd love to know kind of about like, yeah, how you figure out what details are important. And kind of like what it's like really getting into the trenches of people's like day-to-day life.
She's like, well, step number one, you need to go to the basement stacks of Dartmouth and you need to pull out about 85 biographies of Hitler. Then you need to spend a lot of time alone. Right. You spend a lot of time in the basement, which, you know, as a writer and as a historian is a privilege for me, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big bad world and I'm surrounded by books, you know, engaging this. And so, you know, I'm grateful to have the opportunity to write history. The first step towards that, yeah, is, you know, for instance, the Hitler chapters. Yeah, I went to Dartmouth and there's about 85 biographies on the shelf. And you begin to map out your outline and you begin to engage the index of those books. And you are one, taking notes, but you're also tracing their sources. So you're writing down primary sources and those mm-hmm. primary sources are going to take you back to something like August Kubizek, who already referenced The Young Hitler I Knew, where you're getting back to larger stories of their lives. And for me, I'm especially interested in details that are rooted in this question of feeling. I think it is feeling which I think gives such a flavor to our humanity. And our inclination in thinking about the worst people who've ever lived is to suggest that they somehow didn't have feelings. Mm-hmm. Hitler and Stalin and Mao, Mussolini and Kim Il-sung and Lenin behave in a way that is inherently cold when they're in power, yet they're also still capable of feelings at times. And in their youths, there are very strong emotions. And so for me, that's looking at the story of Lenin's older brother dying, a moment of immense heartache for young Volodya, or looking at the death of Hitler's mother, where a teenage Adolf is absolutely crushed and will actually bow to the Austrian Jewish physician who takes care of his mother and will say, "I'll never forget what you did for my mother." And he'll later, when the Nazis seize Austria, allow this man to leave the country, who will write an article when he's living in the US describing like no one else was treated like this, me as an Austrian Jewish person. Moments of feeling, which, and now I think we also get back to an uncomfortable place. Are you allowed to feel for those who don't deserve feeling? Mm-hmm. Can you feel for 20 something Stalin, so-so, as his first wife dies in his arms? Again, is that the height of complicity or is it the antithesis of their tyranny? I think you should feel for teenage Hitler mourning his mother. He wasn't yet a Nazi dictator. He was not the monstrous despot he would later become. I think when we think about, Mao Zedong mourning his mother at her funeral, saying that, "Mom, you know, I'm going to take up your mission of making this world a better place." Not only do we feel, and it heightens our engagement with a given text, it begins to help, returns us to the core theme that these people are human beings. All right, so Longerich. I mean, you know, now, okay, you're referencing like this dude's Beethoven, all right? Like, so this guy's Beethoven. And when I start a project like this, like I have a doctorate in history, but like I'm not going to go live in Germany for 8 years and just like only live like in archives around Germany and be able to do that and make a living. And so this guy is Beethoven, you know, someone like Stephen Kotkin's Mozart, like my aspiration is to aspirationally, you know, I don't want to suggest delusions of grandeur here, mm-hmm. but like, I would like to be like Blind Lemon Jefferson playing a one-string guitar with a broken bottle for slide. And I'm really interested, like, is like, you know, Blind Lemon Jefferson playing a one-string guitar with a broken bottle for slide, can that be more meaningful than listening to the New York Philharmonic?
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
I think what's missing from Longerich is the feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm imagining myself, not a historian at all. I'm imagining myself because the difference between your book and like something that Longerich would write is that you are selecting, I think, I don't want to toot your horn too much,
John, there'll be lots of people who hate me. Don't worry. Right ahead, please.
You have to kind of like wade through the fine details of everyone's life. And then you've got to do the action of like selecting which ones are relevant for the thesis or the project that you're working on, which is, you know, shining a light on their childhood and like what makes them human. Longer, it's just like every detail. Like he's like Joyce and you're like Beckett, right? Like Joyce is like all of life. Longerich is like the totality of everything that ever happened to Joseph Goebbels is going to be in this book. He's not really doing much of a selective process. Like, I mean, I really feel like I know absolutely everything about Goebbels' life. And I mean, that is his project, right? Like, that's what it seems like to me.
I would like Longerich to write more like John Lindsay. What do I mean by that? I mean that there is an artistry of style. And you know, like when I spent last summer with Body High for like 8 hours, like outside by a pool, like there are parts of that book that just like hit me in the gut. Mm. Like, oh, there's the line. I forget the guy's name. Like it's his friend and they're trying to save this young woman, you know, the person he's having the incestuous affair with. But anyway, he's just like, we're going to save her. Like reading that book, there are certain lines like I couldn't get out of my head. Mm-hmm. As much as I profoundly respect Peter Longerich and I think his books are extraordinary, I don't have lines from his books ringing throughout my head in a way that like I do. So now we're also getting to a new place. Are there like Princeton historians who will have the temerity to write like someone like John Lindsay or like who is going to be? And I think we can say this without like diminishing like the historical significance, like the seriousness of the events we're talking about.
Right.
I think that we can call upon historians to write in a way that is more profound, even if Body High is a completely separate genre, a completely different subject. There is writing in my mind that is profound. And I think all too often we only look to the New York Philharmonic for like what that will be in history. And so that informed a lot of how I wanted to write Before Evil. Like for me, like, you know, like who's the Henry Miller of historical scholarship? Mm-hmm. Like no one's writing like Henry Miller. Like no one's actually like aspiring to that.
It's interesting. I have been thinking about this quite a bit. Like there are a few historians that maybe kind of bridge the gap, right? Like I think like Shelby Foote would be a good example of somebody who writes in a really beautiful way, or I'm sure there are others. I really like that Edmund Morris like trilogy about Theodore Roosevelt. And, and so, I mean, there's some that are very like artistic, but I absolutely get what you're saying, which is, yeah, like what my writing professors call the heartbeats of a story, the things that really kind of get inside you and stay there and make you feel something. And bridging that gap is an interesting project. You know, your book is very interesting because it is, you know, if you were trying to write history that is extremely readable and I guess emotionally compelling, you definitely succeeded, right? Like, I don't know, I'd really, you know, maybe in the intro to this episode, I'll read a passage or two that really stuck out to me. But it's an interesting project. And like, I mean, what do you think about historical fiction as a genre, right? Like what has that crossed your mind? Is it something that you've considered doing?
Well, no. So I published the book with Tortoise Books. And in the end of the day, I had, you know, a few different opportunities like where I could take the book. And I read Gerald Brennan's Resistance. Like I know you talked to Jerry previously.
Yeah, I love his writing too.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, right? And like his Altered Space series is really good. Mm-hmm. And so like in terms of historical fiction that blends nonfiction and fiction, Resistance and his space books are really, really cool. But like for me, the things that have actually happened, the things that we know have happened are I can't get it out of my mind.
Right. I mean, it's weird enough.
I need to tell those stories in a way that I think is has a larger purpose. And, you know, I'd like to think the book is accessible. I'd like to think that it is super engaging. But again, it comes back to the larger why. And I think historians and writers of all backgrounds, whether they're academic or not, need to challenge readers and individuals to grapple with profound concepts, grapple with profound concepts that define the meaning of reality. I mean, like, this is what I like, you know, about
All right. So like with Leaf Society and Tao Lin, like there's things like I would disagree with Tao Lin about, like, but I'd really, like want to sit and have I'd want to like talk to him one-on-one and like have coffee and like really engage on that. Like better yet, Tao Lin, if you're listening, like, will you garden with me? Like, that's what I want. Like, I know you're into gardening. If I come to Hawaii, like, can we hang out in your garden and talk about that? Yeah. But what I'm really trying to say is I think Tao Lin's discussion of the mystery and the notion of things beyond us that we can't explain. I almost see this connection with a Kantian discussion of philosophy about things that are metaphysical, that are beyond us, that like inspire awe because like we'll never be able to get to the bottom of it in terms of like experience. And I think like he does that in Leaf Society by talking about the mystery. And I'm like, okay, like we're going from a book, which is like, you know, talking about a variety of subjects in a colorful way that I agree and disagree with, but like, I think he's doing something important. And like, well, I find myself talking about the mystery to other people and like, we should feel awe and joy at these things around us. And I don't know, you know, it's not the Princeton historian. Like it's Tao Lin.
Yeah.
And it's reading Tripp at times as well. Right. And like, in grappling with some of what he's saying, that's really profound for me.
It's really interesting. I agree. I mean, this is an obvious point too, but I think a huge issue about even fanaticism, like what we've been talking about this most of this episode, is people who disagree not gardening together, right? Like that is the huge source of what the issue is. And so one of the questions that I've had, because I look, we've discussed what people probably say is like to you all the time, which is why just leave it alone? Why do we have to talk about these people's lives? Like, let's just ignore, like, what benefit is it, right? But what do you think about, like, I hesitate to use the word like censorship, right? But what do you think about, you know, from an academic or like institutional standpoint, when people are like, well, let's not teach certain things, let's not discuss certain things, let's not have this person speak at our college, right? Like, what, how do you see the lessons that you've learned throughout history? Like, you know, where does that lead you today? Like, how do you feel about those types of issues? And I don't want to get you caught in some political thing. That's not what I'm trying to do. These are things that I think about often, right? Like, how do we bridge the gap? Is it by just brushing these things under the rug, which I think you would say the answer is no, which I bet has led you to a lot of arguments at dinner tables and at bars. But
I think the tension is there are debates, right, where we might vehemently disagree, but I would say there's part of me that will fall back on the kind of, maybe it's a cliche at this point, it's Voltaire saying that, you know, like, and I'm paraphrasing, I utterly disagree with every single thing you've said, but I'd fight to my dying breath for your right to say it. Mm-hmm. But then looking at the reality of where totally unshackled free speech can go, things can get really ugly. And obviously there's some things, forms of speech that are not allowed. Like, right. You can't sexually harass people in the workplace. Like, right. That is not allowed. You right. Can't commit libel. Right. Like, I can't just write like slanderous things about you. So like, there are appropriate checks on language that are part of our daily reality, which people completely ignore sometimes when they talk about free speech. Like, well, you would admit like there are some forms of speech that like, are not appropriate. Like, it's actually illegal. Like, you're actually right. Going
to get trouble. You'll go to prison for threatening like an official or, you know, an individual. Well,
there are moments. Yeah. So I would frame this with a degree of humility that these are extraordinarily complex things. And particularly when we're talking about the intersection of like the trauma of history with how people engage with it right now, I think my first step would be always to listen, right? And to think about what others have to say in terms of how language affects them and what they think. That, you know, that being said, as a historian, I also think appropriately framed that we have the obligation to try and grapple with primary sources and stories of what has happened. And a lot of times it's gonna be disturbing. I just think how we do that has to be really carefully framed, so it's appropriate, right? If we're going to listen to a speech by Hitler, I think we need to be extra careful how we set up that discussion, and we do everything we can to make sure that in no way is this being perceived as romanticizing. But what really, something I saw in the last couple of years, and I believe you tweeted about it recently, is the QAnon documentary through HBO. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is actually, yes, that's exactly correct. That was me, and I had to delete some of my tweets. I did tweet about the QAnon documentary into the storm, and this is essentially what I'm talking about when I ask you this question, because this is the big elephant in the room, right? It's like these people.
Well, you have an example of where totally unrestrained free speech forums can go. And on 8chan and then 4chan, like, this is causing people to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's repeat that.
Like, for sure, 100%.
People indisputable. Are being murdered. And so I think we have to have some real hard conversations. And, you know, I think there is a balance between we have an emphatic disagreement and I state my, you know, willingness to fight for your right to say an opinion versus other speech that's putting people's lives at risk, right? That's actually leading to mass murder. I think that's something separate. And I think we need to have some real hard conversations about what we can do to struggle against that, because we have the obligation to humanize those we find abhorrent because we want to prevent these things from happening. Yeah, we also have to have the courage to fight and struggle against what we find disgusting and repugnant. But what I would say a theme of Before Evil is to reference what George Kennan said at the beginning of the Cold War. He said that as the United States start to struggle against the Soviet Union, what, you know, Reagan will call an evil empire later on, George Kennan said, as we seek to combat, you know, this evil, the greatest danger we face is that in struggling against it, we find ourselves becoming like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that is always we have in front of us what we know we need to struggle against, but we need to make sure that no matter what, that we still always consider human stories. And as we hold people accountable, we recognize the humanity of the worst among us as well as the best among us. Mm-hmm. And we recognize that we ourselves can become radicalized and find ourselves doing terrible things. Humility, love,
absolutely,
passion, yeah, alongside strength and courage.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, I mean, listen, I completely agree. I think,
yeah, what do you think, John? What I mean, like, so the QAnon, like, what, and we're talking about, you know, this notion of free speech. Where is your head at on this?
I what do I think about free speech? I actually think, okay, I have changed basically. Okay, so let me preface this by saying, pretty recently, through NYU, where I go to school, was introduced to Hari Kunzru, who's a writer. I don't know if you're familiar with him. And he wrote this book called The Red Pill. And I was pretty interested in how he immersed himself in certain worlds, right? Like the Chan worlds. And I'll say this, I'm a lawyer by trade. I went to law school. I don't think I've ever told anybody that on the podcast. But so I was more or less for a while a free speech absolutist, I guess I would say, other than maybe direct threats of violence. And yeah, I think I had a pretty clear cut, you know, not, I would really hesitate to categorize speech as violence in 99.9% of cases. That being said, in kind of doing my own research about these communities and learning about QAnon and visiting 4chan, right? Like, especially when Ukraine started, because this is sort of like unfettered access to the front line. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll learn something that I wouldn't learn on Reuters, right? Because it's just some guy with a phone anonymously. So anyway, now I'm really confused because I don't think that they should. I think that that should be policed more. And I don't know how you do it, but like clever ways that they advocate for violence against minority populations and the like subtle ways that they radicalize people.
And the codes.
The codes.
I have where I live. A driver's plate that has the acronym for, you know, where we go one, we go all. And I immediately see that and I remark, you know, to my wife, like, that's a QAnon reference.
Absolutely. And it's, and like
you see these codes around you and that they're all coming from those places.
The irony and the ability to hide behind irony. I don't know what can, this is why I'm asking you is about that. I don't know what can be done about it, but like, right, the guy's manifesto was the Buffalo shooter's manifesto was posted on 4chan the other day, right? And people are making jokes about, oh, he got one more than Dylan Roof. Should that be allowed? Now, everything I've once believed about free speech, I'm not really sure. And then I get, we have to stop this speech. And I know that that's not how the United States operates. And I know that's, and I'm obviously not an expert on the topic, but like, we don't have the power constitutionally right now to address this.
I think, you know, what you're talking about, confusion, I feel energized by that. Like one of the smartest things I ever heard a professor say, you know, this dude is a genius and he's published for years, you know, saying that the more I've learned, the, you know, the more confused I have become. And, but we still have the obligation to stand up for what's right. Like, you know, confusion and the notion of like extensive analysis does not like suggest that like, well, you know, you don't have to be involved because it's all too confusing because some things are very clearly right and wrong. Like some things are obviously right and wrong, but the reality of how you get into the nitty gritty of these problems requires a degree of humility amid that confusion. And yet also the courage to try to make decisions about what is right or wrong. And the willingness to grapple with facts that challenge one's convictions with, I think, the appreciation for the fact that I don't have everything figured out. And particularly when you have people being murdered, you know, after that documentary, you know, I went to 4chan and looked at that site. I was horrified.
And the thing about it is that, you know, the thing that kind of blew my mind was because so much of it is like subliminal and like you say, speaking in code and irony, and it's couched in humor. So it's very digestible. They use the cute little frog Pepe and they use funny images, but the messages are horrible. Right. So my professor who spent 4 years on there, I'm like, how do you avoid becoming radicalized? It becomes a noxious environment that you're in, but I don't know what legally we can do about it. I don't know.
Think we also have to embrace the fact that we have agency, and I think what we do matters, you know. And I think if we can't give way to the notion that there's nothing that can be done, there are things can be done, and they will have to be done. You know, and I think as we study the past, we come away from the notion there is something to learn. And as horrific things happen, we have the obligation to grapple with what can be done to struggle against this because it's profoundly wrong.
Right, right. And I really do appreciate not losing sight of the fact that it is wrong. There's right and wrong. And there are things that deserve to be, that we should fight for. And it gives me some optimism. So, you know what, for that reason and many more though, I just feel that this book is uber timely. And, you know, I think Tortoise is fantastic. I'm glad it found a good home. And, I feel like I only interview people. So it's kind of redundant. I only interview people that I'm deeply impressed with, but, I'm going to be recommending this book to everybody and, really awesome accomplishment. So
that's really nice. I really appreciate your kind words. They mean a lot. And so I look forward to speaking again soon, John. This is an awesome interview series. You've had so many good interviews. So I look forward to hearing everything else that'll come.
Well, we'll definitely keep in touch. Thanks so much for chatting with me and I really learned a lot. And, yep, we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, my pleasure, John. Have a nice night, okay?
You too.
Farewell, stranger.